On today's program, we're going to be transforming lives and relationships by increasing self-awareness with my special guest, Dr. Carla Marie Manley. I'm Richard Brendan, and this is Journey's Fire. I'm glad you joined us today. We're going to do something a little bit different today. I have an author on, not only a clinical psychologist, but an author, and she's cranked out two great books in the same year. We're going to be covering both of those books in the time that we have. The first one is Joy from Fear, Create the Life of Your Dreams by Making Fear Your Friend, and I find that so timely, especially with the increase of fear that we find in our country these days. And a second one, Aging Joyfully, A Women's Guide to Optimal Health, Relationships, and Fulfillment, for her 50s and beyond, but I have read the book, and it's also appropriate for you guys as well. Dr. Carla Manley is a clinical psychologist based in Sonoma County, California. Using a holistic mind-body-spirit approach, Dr. Manley works with individuals and groups on transformational growth and healing. She's also a leading authority in the area of fear-based disorders, including trauma, anxiety, and depression. I'm thrilled that she's on today's program, and she comes to us from Santa Rosa, California. Dr. Carla Manley, thank you so much for being with me today.
Thank you for having me. I so appreciate it.
Yeah, I've enjoyed both of your books, actually. Which one, actually, did you finish first, the Aging Joyfully or Joy from Fear?
I finished Joy from Fear first.
Okay. And what was the impetus for writing that book? Because clearly, we are living in a time right now in our country where fear is at an all-time high. And I've often said that it's fear that can chain your soul and keep you from flying as high and as far as you're destined to go. So I'm glad we're starting with that topic first. You, in your book, you say why fear makes a much better friend than an enemy. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about why we should befriend fear.
So the reason I wrote Joy from Fear, and it was actually initially called My Fear, My Friend. Uh-huh. So the reason I wrote it, when I was in doctoral school, I realized that my life before that time was very much lived in fear. Mm. Fear of displeasing other people, fear of not being perfect, fear of, you know, this, fear of that. Had someone asked me if I had lived a life based in fear, I would have said, absolutely not. I'm a strong, powerful, courageous woman. But when I realized that I wasn't living the life of my dreams and I had to get to the bottom of that, I realized that it was indeed fear. So I started researching fear. I wanted to understand fear. And what I realized is that we have categories of fear. We have rational fear, fear of, you know, getting bit by a snarling dog. That's a rational fear.
Sure.
Fear of a firestorm coming over the hill if we live in a fire area.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely rational fears. The bulk of our fears, however, are not rational fears. And I look at those fears that run around in the unconscious mind but really control our lives. I look at those fears as unconscious fears that are destructive in nature because they run our lives. It is the mantra of, I am not good enough, or I should be doing this, or I should not do that. I better do this. Oh, I better, you know, stay in this jail cell of a job or a relationship because I'm not worth more. So those are all our destructive fears that keep us from, as you said, flying as high as we are meant to fly.
Yeah, yeah. In your clinical practice, how often do you see as one of the roots of a presenting issue fear and fear-based thinking?
Most of the time, if not all the time.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I thought.
And what I find is that if we learn, so how do we get to make fear our friend?
Mm-hmm.
And this is where I broke it apart into destructive fear, constructive fear, and transformational fear. So when we are blind, when we are unconscious, destructive fear runs our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And we just move along, going through the motions of life.
Mm-hmm.
When we slow it down, really slow it down, body, mind, and spirit, and begin to listen to the voice, whatever you want to call it, divine, goodness, essential humanity. When we begin to listen to the constructive voice that tells us what our purpose is, that we are good, that we know the truth, that we can find the truth. We start listening to the good voice within us, not the terrorizing, bullying voice, mm-hmm. but the voice of wisdom, the voice of sanity, right? Mm-hmm. That is constructive fear. And I get a lot of my clients get to that level. A lot of people in life get to that level where they can differentiate and they can hear something positive coming through. However, getting to transformational fear, that third piece, that's where it's even more difficult, because then we have to take our fledgling awareness, our growing awareness, and we actually have to light it on fire by taking action. And that's the part that is so hard, because we want to change, but we don't want to change.
Right.
I call it being comfortably uncomfortable. We live these lives that are less than what we want. We're not flying high where we want to be, where we know we have the power to be. And so we constrict ourselves and don't take action to break free of that which limits us.
So it's really about facing your fear and learning how to do it anyway, walking through that fear that's there.
Yes, it is about facing the fear and listening to the fear. Mm-hmm. It actually has a message. If mm-hmm. we learn to see both sides of it and then take action, because some people say, oh, you know, make it over your fears, overcome your fears, or run from your fears. I say it differently than that. I say hold the fear, mm-hmm. get close to it, explore it, take mm-hmm. it for what it's worth, learn from it. It becomes your friend, mm-hmm. and then use that power, convert it, to be your ally.
How early? Now, I personally don't believe we're born with it, that we probably learn it along the way. I mean, is that something you agree with?
I absolutely agree. I think in some cases, an environment while mm-hmm. the child's in utero, mm-hmm. I think that it can be so toxic mm-hmm. that there are cases where a child is born with deep fear. Mm-hmm. That would have, you know, those are the rare situations, maybe increasingly common.
Yeah.
But I think that most children, if they are born into good enough households,
uh-huh.
most
yeah.
of our fears are learned when life, mm-hmm. you know, parents are cruel, brothers mm-hmm. and sisters are cruel, or mm-hmm. they're inattentive,
mm-hmm.
and then we go to school and people are unkind and teachers can be cruel or not protect us, and then we go through life accumulating all of these wounds.
Yeah.
And if we don't become aware of the wounds and process the wounds and learn to use the wounds to become stronger people, more mm-hmm. aware, mm-hmm. then I think that fear just loves that. It likes to destructive fear just really takes a hold of mm-hmm. that.
And based on your experience in your clinical practice, about at what age typically do people start learning this fear behavior?
And I think it's so much the family environment.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's a toxic family environment, and I'm, you know, kind of my mind is flying through some of my clients, because in preverbal years, you know, and often prior to age 7,
mm-hmm.
childhood amnesia keeps people's memories often, you know, somewhat diluted, if not absent, before age 7. And so I'll often hear people, even though some clients have memories from 3 or 5 or 7, 6 years old, but most people will come up with a memory from maybe kindergarten, sometimes first grade, which would be around 6 years old.
Yeah.
And they will say, oh my God, I remember this. Dad came home and took a sledgehammer to, you know, mom's, you know, X, Y, and Z, or, you know, my brother pinned me in a corner and, you know, beat me, or whatever it is. So you'll get to these memories, and there are often, once you open the door, there's often more than one.
Mm-hmm.
Or they'll remember mom and dad fighting, and again, you know, those are the memories. These are our role models. So whatever mom and dad are doing, be it good or not so good, that becomes part of the child's very young brain, and memories are formed all around that.
Yeah.
So I think it happens very, very early in life.
And what would you say to someone who's listening who experienced some severe trauma in their life, whether it be an abuse situation or perhaps even a war veteran that has PTSD, and in that relation to fear?
I believe so much in the power of PTSD to immobilize our lives, and with veterans and with a lot of people think that PTSD is limited to veterans. Mm-hmm. And of course we know once we get into it that PTSD can affect people of all walks of life. You can have PTSD if you've witnessed violence, if you've been a victim of rape, a victim of bullying. PTSD is not confined to veterans, although I do volunteer with veterans, so I do see it in that population.
Yeah.
And so what I encourage listeners to look at is, and if you say, look at the chapter in Joy from Fear that's focused on PTSD and its close relatives, look at your life, look at your symptoms. Are you hypervigilant? Mm-hmm. Are you really watching for the next attack around the corner? That's often a sign of PTSD. Is your sleep affected? Is your interest in life affected? Are you, you know, having trouble regulating your emotions? There are a litany of symptoms that come with PTSD. And one of the most important things to realize, whether you suffer from PTSD, anxiety, or depression, or a combination, is that you are not broken.
Mm-hmm.
You are not irreparable. You are not worthless. You are a human being who has suffered in life. And just like a physical ailment, our physical ailments don't get better on their own. You have a broken leg, you seek, you know, help from a doctor. If you have PTSD or some other mental health issue, you need help. And it doesn't mean you're bad or weak. It simply means that life has given you an event or events that have really caused you mental harm.
I think what you just said is so key, the fact that you're not broken, because oftentimes when we're dealing with really severe and deep issues that we might even be embarrassed about, so we don't want anyone else to know about it, we're feeling that way about ourselves, and that just kind of feeds that darkness inside of us, it seems like.
Absolutely. Because I deal with this almost every day, and I'm so glad you brought it up. We compare ourselves to the other, whether it's the neighbor, whether it's the kid in school, whether it's the person at the next desk. And it's one of the problems with social media is people present their happy lives, or what they wish their lives looked like, or maybe their lives are. And so people consciously and unconsciously compare themselves. So if they're suffering from anxiety, the Facebook or social media posts they look are all happy or all positive, or the neighbor's driving the brand new fancy car and just got a promotion and their life looks perfect, then we automatically assume we are the only ones suffering from anxiety, depression, panic attacks. And I can tell you that some of the people you are looking at, you think whose lives are so perfect, they're likely somebody's client, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Or they're on a medication. And, and, you know, and so that's the part where it takes courage to seek support to work through your life's hardships. It just does. It takes courage. And I so applaud my clients who come in for their sessions, whether it's group therapy or individual therapy, or because it's to me, that's the work of life.
Yes.
That's what life is here for, so that we can continue to create a work of art out of the person that we are.
Well, and I applaud the work that you do, because I don't know of too many people that have really dealt with their stuff and go deep without the help of a professional. Be it a counselor, maybe if it's a work-related thing, a coach, but I think everybody needs somebody to go to get those tune-ups or to even go a little deeper. So, yeah, I haven't seen too many people being able to do that, although what I love about your books is in both of these books, there are exercises that people can do for self-reflection and such. You also weave in, and that's my favorite part, because I love stories of real-life people who were dealing with things. And I'd like for you, if you can, to share a little bit about a story in your book about fear regarding Alexander the Gentle Veteran. Mm-hmm. And it was a case study, and that really touched my heart.
Mm-hmm. And so when you look at the case studies in Joy from Fear, they're amalgamations of my clients, and again, I volunteer with veterans. It's one of my joys.
Yeah.
And when you look at what happens with many of our veterans, and I'm not saying this is exclusive to veterans, but let's look at Alexander, who comes from a family where the father was very difficult. The father was abusive. So the person grows up already sensitive to verbal abuse, physical abuse, living in a world where he had to walk on eggshells, mm-hmm. just waiting mm-hmm. for the next punch to come his way, mm-hmm. right? And then begins to live a life that is, we often don't go deep or know how to go deep. So we reach for substances, we reach for items, we think we can, fix it by drinking, by smoking, by having lots of gratuitous sex, and that will make us feel better. But really it doesn't, because that just creates a bigger hole in the soul. Then you take a situation like Alexander, where then let's add in military combat, right? The military world, where you're taught certainly not to feel your emotions. You're taught to be tough. You're taught to be, in some ways really, really brutal and very divided from your emotional world. So that takes somebody who's already has a childhood of trauma and a lifetime of trauma, and then it compounds it. So you're watching friends getting, blown up, or really horrific incidents in the military realm. And so the trauma just keeps getting worse. So what does the individual do? They keep finding ways to self-soothe. Often anger comes, there are huge anger management issues because this really speaks to men.
Mm-hmm.
In particular, women, thank goodness, we're allowed emotions. We're allowed to be happy, sad, joyful, scared. That's kind of normal for a woman, even though, unfortunately, many people will say a woman who feels her feelings is too emotional or too sensitive, when actually she's just feeling her feelings.
Absolutely.
And about managing
yes.
that.
Yes.
But let's go back to the veteran, who our men are allowed, veteran or not, our men are allowed two emotions in our world, and they're not even really emotions, because one of them is what I call okay, the emotion of okay or I'm fine, and the other one, which is an emotion, is anger. So most men that you run into that I, work with, when they start with me, they will either be angry or they're okay, I'm fine. And so then we look at Alexander, one of his best friends was anger. And in order to be able to get into a way of having a healthy relationship with himself and then his partner, was to teach Alexander what an emotion was, what a feeling was, and how he could learn, and talk about empowerment. When he learned that he could actually control his anger, that he could learn to take steps to control his anger rather than let it control him and really create havoc in his life as it harmed other people and loved ones, he became so proud of himself. In the first, I would venture to say, one of the first real ways he had ever felt proud, not proud of being strong or proud of being in combat or proud of making money, but he was proud of the man he was. And so that's kind of, in the nutshell, the journey of Alexander.
So anger is one of the many ways that we express fear, is what I'm hearing you say.
Oh, that is such a good question, such a good point. And
I'm bringing,
and no.
Okay. Well, I'm bringing that up because I came across a quote. I don't know who said it, but I was thinking about it, and especially in terms of today, what's going on in our country, and that is, things are not getting worse, they're getting uncovered. We must hold each other tight and continue to pull back the veil. One of the things that surprised me, not that we take any sides since this is public radio station on politics, but what has surprised me is how great the division is in our country. And as a Civil War buff, and my all-time hero was Abraham Lincoln growing up in Springfield, Illinois myself, it reminds me of almost the Civil War. And I wasn't oblivious to prejudice and to bigotry and things like that. I guess to the degree that I've witnessed it lately has bothered me, which oftentimes is based in fear. And I wonder, because of that fear, do sometimes people express that through anger? Maybe that's where my question was coming from.
Okay. And it's two pieces, so I'm going to directly answer your question.
Uh-huh.
Yes. Anger can be a response to fear.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, absolutely, we can become angry. Here's a good example. About probably 2 years ago, somebody almost ran over me in a parking lot because they weren't looking. And my first response was fear, but it got covered over by anger. I remember standing there and going, you know, thinking out loud, why don't you get a driving lesson kind of thing,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And so, but I just stood there frozen, didn't say anything, and I realized, wait a second, I'm not really angry at this person. I'm just terrified. I was just terrified.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a really good example of how anger, you know, that feeling inside, you know, get a driving lesson, right? Even if you, whether you speak it or not, you still had that, I still had that response. So that came from a place of fear. I wasn't angry at the person, and it diminished, and I walked away, and the person drove off, and everything was fine. But, you know, that response can be, so answering that, yes,
mm-hmm.
anger can be covering fear. However, let's go really quickly into a vital lesson on what is an emotion.
Okay.
An emotion is different from a feeling, and so this it'll take about a minute, 2 minutes. So we are given the paradigm I follow is the five emotion model. It's the simplest.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We have anger, mm-hmm. fear, disgust, sadness, and joy.
Mm-hmm.
People often will say, so we have four good emotions and one bad. I think they're all good emotions because they serve a purpose. So from an evolutionary framework, each one matters. Here's why. We are, let's pretend we, you know, we're 50,000 years ago, and I'm a mama, and a bear comes up, and it's going to take my food, right? I will be angry,
mm-hmm.
right? I will be angry because somebody's taking the food that I need for me and my baby.
Sure.
So I will be angry. You know, somebody, let's say, somebody comes and takes my water. I will be angry because I need that water.
Mm-hmm.
It's an emotion in its own right. It plays a part in me standing up for me and my belongings that I need to take care of my family. So that's anger. Let's go to disgust. Why is disgust important? Why is it a primary emotion? I eat a berry that I'm going to make a berry dinner. You know, this is a long time ago, so maybe all I had were berries. And I eat one to test it, and it doesn't taste good. I spit it out and therefore have saved my family from getting toxic berries. That's the purpose of disgust. Sadness. My baby is sick, and it's in my arms. It's limp. It has a fever. I'm going to be very, very sad and do whatever I can to save that baby's life, thus ensuring survival of the species.
Mm.
Sadness has a role. Fear. You know, a rattlesnake comes in and is hissing at me, and I'm going to pull back, take my baby into my cave, and keep us safe because fear taught me I need to retreat slowly and safely to get away from the rattlesnake.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah.
So fear plays a part. Why does joy come in? Because if it weren't for joy, that little baby in my arms that's cooing at me, I might not bother to care for it. I've got to get something out of this. I've got to feel love. I've got to feel joy. So that's why joy comes in. So those are emotions. That's why we have emotions. That's why we have a basic set of emotions. Each one serves a very primitive purpose. So how do we get a feeling? A feeling is what happens when that instant gut emotion goes to the brain, the sensations go to the brain, make sense of it based on prior history and come out as a feeling.
Hmm.
That is why you can talk about, you know, Lincoln being your favorite president, and you'll have warm and fuzzy good feelings that result from that, where someone who didn't think much of Lincoln, based on their history.
Right.
You know, it'll go, they may have a feeling that comes out and be one of absolute irritation. We don't know. So that's how it works.
And that's what we see being played out in our country today. Clearly, we're all looking at same people or same past people, and we all have different opinions of that. You know, listening to you, I'm already thinking about a few friends of mine who literally have been selling themselves short because of fear. So my question for you, Carla, is as friends, as spouses, even as parents, how can we empower our loved ones to make fear their friend if someone is just being paralyzed by their fear?
One of the ways, which is why I took it down to those basic emotions, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Once we become aware that each of those emotions is valuable, mm-hmm. is trying to tell us something. Anger's not a bad emotion. It's a very healthy emotion. It's how we use it. Mm-hmm. So if somebody is paralyzed in fear, then being able to go to that loved one and, for example, saying, you know, hey, honey, I see that you're really miserable coming home from work every day. Tell me what's going on.
Yeah.
And the person may say, I'm fine. Everything's okay,
uh-huh,
right?
Uh-huh.
And then being able to say, yeah, that's interesting. Tell me more about that. Tell me more about what's going on for you. What does fine feel like? Hmm. Or, you know, waking up with a loved one who says, oh, you know, I had bad dreams. Or I'm sleepless. Not here's a Tylenol PM for you, mm-hmm, but instead saying, tell me what's going on. What's going on? Tell me about the dreams. You know, and starting to look at what's going on in one's life. Another piece I love about Joy from Fear is it really helps you slow down your life and look at your life to see what is contributing to help your loved one find out why aren't they sleeping well? Why are you anxious? What's going on? Starting, you'll notice, Richard, what I'm talking about is self-awareness.
Yeah.
Becoming more, you are a beautiful instrument. Every listener is a beautiful instrument, you know, a human instrument. And slowing it down to find out, it's not about what's right for your neighbor, what's right for the person and what's working for them. It's about what is working right for you. When you find it, do more of it.
Mm-hmm.
When something's not working well for you,
mm-hmm.
do less of it.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's practical.
It is practical, isn't it? Hard to do. That's
yes.
the part where transformational fear really requires us to slow it down and begin looking. And here's a good example. For me, I'm not big on watching news or mm-hmm. television. Mm-hmm. And evening news is particularly tough on me because I really like winding down slowly.
Yes,
you know, talk about Abraham Lincoln, right?
Yeah.
You want to be in touch with the morning and the night and the natural rhythms of life as best you can. And so for me, it's about slowing down in the evening, keeping free of negative things, slowing my body down, slowing kind of the environment down so that sleep comes naturally.
Mm.
You wake up with the sun, you're refreshed, you're joyful, and you do it again the next day, right?
Right.
So many of us are going to sleep with really negative evening news, negative commercials, talking about, you know, drugs and take this and take that and do this and do that. And this, how can our dreams not become littered with the detritus of fear? And so really taking a close look at your life to find out how are you treating your psyche and your body as you wake up? Because that's the template for your day. If the first thing you reach for is your phone and social media and a cup of coffee, you know, and get that adrenaline and cortisol going, right, then your day is likely to follow that template.
Mm-hmm.
If your first thing is maybe a 5-minute, you know, prayer or gratitude mm-hmm. or quiet meditation,
mm-hmm.
then your day will likely follow suit. And then also treating your evening. And I think when we help our loved ones and our own lives with creating a template that feels more down to earth, we cannot help but be happier.
So what role does physical exercise, or I would even say also meditation, things like yoga, play in relation to fear, to transform it?
I think it plays a huge role. I am a yoga teacher, meditation leader, yoga practitioner. I really believe that our ancestors in the not-too-distant past exercised as a part of their lives. 150 years ago, we were exercising every day for a good portion of the day. It was how we lived.
Yes, right.
And so now we've divorced ourselves from, you know, thousands and thousands of years of evolution. We are now sitting still for the bulk of the day. Mm-hmm. And our bodies are meant to walk, to move, to bend. And I really think that it's so important. 12 minutes of exercise per day is sufficient to boost your mood. Research proves that. And so one of the things I really encourage people to do is walk. If you can't run, you know, if you can't do jumping jacks, go for a walk. Go for 12 minutes and then see if you can get it up at some point to 20 and see how enjoyable it is to be out with nature. And if you don't live close to nature and have, you know, city streets available, to do something like that every day. And then the piece about meditation. A lot of people are confused that meditation, and they think it needs to be a very formal, strict, you know, practice where you sit in silence for an hour every day.
Yeah.
I volunteer at a drug and alcohol rehab center once a week, mm-hmm. and I lead meditation there, and I teach through guided meditation. If somebody wants to do a guided meditation with me, they can find me on YouTube at Dr. Carla Manley and do a guided meditation with me. And what you'll find is there are many ways to do meditation, whether a guided meditation for a half hour or 5 minutes, or you can do a meditation like I do. I have 5 minutes at least every morning where I'm listening to soft music. I'm setting my intentions for the day. I'm, you know, preparing a cup of tea. So meditation does not always have to be seated. It can simply be, I have a friend who loves raking leaves as her meditation. Working in the garden can be meditative. So really all that meditation is about learning to detach from our thoughts, that the thoughts don't have to rule us, that we can kind of see them as clouds floating by and detach from them as much as possible. So I think those practices help us get away from the inner voice that perpetuates fear. That's my specialty, is teaching people how to get away from whatever you call it, the monkey mind or the hamster wheel mind,
yes.
or the scurrying mind,
yes.
helping you realize that you can actually back off from that, that that be, can become a choice once you become aware of it, that you are not your mind.
So if there was one piece of advice, Carla, that you could give to anyone who suffers from paralyzing fear and anxiety, and there, I know there are quite a few out there who go through that. What would that advice be?
The advice would be, as I said earlier, first, know you're not broken.
Mm-hmm.
Simply know you simply have created bad habits through no fault of your own, that it's our culture, it's the world we live in. It thrives on fear and unconscious fear. So that's the first thing. The second thing is reach out for support. If you can't afford a therapist, see if you can find a support group, a clinic, you know, through your community center, somewhere where you can start talking about what is going on for you so that you can start understanding it. Another way to do it, you know, is to buy a book like Joy from Fear that has exercises in it,
mm-hmm.
and use it with a book club. Use it with a men's group as, you know, one book that you share amongst yourselves, and do the journey with other people, because life is so much more fun when you realize that you're not alone, that the issues that I run a women's group every Thursday night, right? And the women routinely say, I felt so alone before I came here, and now I realize that my issues might look a little different, but that everybody has them, and how reassuring that is.
Oh, yeah. Well, we're going to make a transition, and I think it's a very smooth transition from the first book we talked about, which was Joy from Fear, to Aging Joyfully. And I was really intrigued by that book because, first of all, the boomer population, the largest population in the country, is getting older. Secondly, with the background, I've had 17 years of hospice work as a chaplain and also director of education. I've seen and witnessed how hard it is for people to embrace their mortality. And we live in a society that through advertisements and such are constantly reminding us how we can be younger and younger and younger. And so I love the subtitle of your book. It's A Woman's Guide to Optimal Health, Relationships, and Fulfillment for Her 50s and Beyond. First of all, why this book? Why this topic?
Again, a perfect question. And I would say this topic, this book, because it's so relevant, as you said, the boomer population, there are so many people struggling mm-hmm. with, and it's interesting, you know, that the part of the title says for women in their 50s and beyond.
Yes.
It was one of the few, this is kind of funny, the publisher wanted it to be a maturation guide for women in her 60s and beyond. And I said, first, women aren't going to like a maturation guide. Nobody wants to be told to mature,
oh, God,
no matter
no,
how old you
no,
are.
Right. Thank
the
you.
The second thing is, in my practice, I'm seeing women in their 20s who are terrified with aging.
Oh, my God.
So I actually advocated for the title to be Women in Her 40s uh-huh. and Beyond, uh-huh. but we split the difference. So it was a happy medium there. But the beautiful part is that is why the book, because our culture has identified somewhere around 18, might be 17, might be 19, as being the ideal age. And that is what a woman, that is her peak. That is what she ought to look like. Mm-hmm. And I completely disagree. I think that every age has its benefits, its gifts, and I think that our ancestors understood that. They understood that the life cycle is beautiful at all of its stages, and that we have the child, we have the maiden, we have, you know, the mother, we have the crone, and how all of those stages are valuable. And indeed, the crone stage, the older woman, the elder stage, is not something to be afraid of
mm-hmm.
or to mm-hmm. pretend doesn't exist. It is and was, in many cultures, a coveted stage. It is the grandmother, the fairy godmother, the wise old woman, right? There is such wisdom. But we focus on the external. Our world is very externally oriented. So we want the package, and you'll notice in Aging Joyfully, I don't tell women to try to look more youthful.
Yeah.
I don't even use that word. I talk about looking more radiant. Mm-hmm. Living more joyfully, exploring who you are and how that is such a beautiful way to approach this next stage of life when our 20s are spent figuring out our identity,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Becoming a couple with somebody often. Then the 30s are about family and, you know, really enriching one's career. Same with early 40s, you know, still caught up with children and career. And that at some point in there, and this is really relevant for men and women, and Aging Joyfully is actually really relevant for men as well, that when we get into our 40s, as our children demand less from us,
mm-hmm.
if we have children,
mm-hmm.
as our jobs are more secure and stable, we then realize, okay, wait a second, I can stop paddling to save my life, right?
Yeah,
I can relax here a little bit. And then once we relax, we realize for many of us that we've lost who we are. We did all of these roles that were performance-oriented, and now it is about waking up to see who's sleeping next to you.
Mm-hmm.
Waking up to see, to really know that person.
Mm-hmm.
Wake up to really see what's inside yourself, who is sleeping within you. And that's why I think Aging Joyfully is such a powerful book, because it, as you saw, there are tips throughout, you know, wisdom
tips. Wisdom tips, yes.
Yes, that are simple and straightforward and doable, so that a person can come out of that sleep that was so productivity-oriented, and realize, wait a second, I'm not on a decline. I am maybe for the first time in my life able to explore who I am and who I want to be.
Yeah, yeah, which is why I think this book is so important for people to read. I think it's so relevant because people do go through those things. I know I have at this stage in my life. My best friend, John, who's a clinical psychologist, we're the same age. We have breakfast every Saturday morning. We'll talk about these very issues we're talking about and how even in relationships, the list, if you will, has changed. Now it's more about communication and partnership and those deeper things that maybe in your 20s, it was a little bit different as well. And I agree with you. I think as we get older, crone, sage, that in many cultures, that is highly valued. Unfortunately, not so much in Western society, it seems like, or at least in this country. And I think people need a reminder that they are to embrace that and are to value that. And you do that so well in this book.
Thank you, and I so agree with you that it is about communication, it is about partnership, it is about self-reflection, and those are some of the things I do believe our culture has been starved. Mm-hmm. We are starved for that depth. We are so busy with a disposable world, so to speak. You know, everything has become disposable, and relationships, people, and we're not disposable. The planet is not disposable. And so I think Aging Joyfully, I really tried to bring it back to a place of realness, to mm-hmm. what matters in life. And to me, what matters in life is, first off, emotional health, mm-hmm. right? Mental health. The overarching psychological health and physical health. And when we, and of course, spiritual health. Without our spiritual health, you know, and some people think it's the same as having an organized religion. No, it's about being in touch with one's divine, whatever that is, mm-hmm. and how we are all interconnected. And so I think when we look at it, I come from a body, mind, spirit paradigm, that when we look at how important we are as individuals and as part of a collective, and that they're inextricably intertwined. That gives it some, you know, sense of gravity, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Sweetness and gravity.
Yes, it does. Yeah. And it's a rethinking about some things. And also, I know there's been a movement taking place, probably the last at least 10 years, if not longer, about finding a new purpose, even in retirement. That doesn't mean that you're dead. I know people go on vacations with a purpose. I think that's what they call it, or service-oriented things. And I find that beautiful because we should be living as full as we can, as long as we can.
I absolutely agree with you. And there is an actual chapter, you know, almost
yes.
in Aging Joyfully devoted to that. But we have various roles throughout life. And as we get older, one of the gifts mm-hmm. is that we are able to find a new purpose, mm-hmm. that we are able to give back, whether that's volunteering, whether, as you said, traveling with a purpose. It is about continuing to unfold. And again, not looking at aging as a decline, but looking at aging as a continued exploration. And maybe we aren't who were in our 20s and 30s. Thank goodness I wouldn't want to be, you know, I wouldn't want to be back there.
And me either. Yeah.
Exactly. And looking at these stages as, oh my goodness, I've accrued this wisdom. I've accrued these gifts. Mm-hmm. And now it is my right and perhaps my responsibility to share them.
Yeah. Yeah. And as I said earlier, this is really not only an inspirational book with the stories and such and the teachings that you have in there, but with the wisdom tips too. I could see people doing a book study together over a book like that and learning together, which would help them then share their stories with each other.
I agree with you. It's interesting when I was writing, And I write in my own very unique way, and I very much am aware that when I'm writing, it's something, it is me, of course. I have to be at my desk and give up my weekends and evenings, but I'm also aware that it's something far beyond me that is coming through me. There is some sort of divine coming through me and guiding me, right? And so one of the things I was called to write about was, hey, and of course this is inspired by my clinical practice, but hey, I want the reader to write a letter of regret to herself. And I remember when a friend of mine, you know, I was talking about this, she said, oh my God, oh, what a horrible thing. Why are you having people write a letter of regret? And I said, well, because we must first look, if we have regrets, we must first look at them, be awakened by them, not held back by them. And that's one of the exercises, is taking the time to slow down, realizing what you didn't do that you wish you had, and what is the gift of that. It's not about getting stuck in the regret. It's about freeing yourself from the regret, because what you may find, indeed, is that something that you thought you regretted actually had gifts that came along because you didn't do that thing. And the other part of it is perhaps it's not too late to give that life in a different way. And so exercises like that are incredibly freeing and inspirational. And then when we are able, and I do think Aging Joyfully, like Joy from Fear, definitely lend themselves to group work. Yeah. I am such a believer in group work, because we are gregarious creatures. We do well when we share, when we feel safe. Mm-hmm. You know, first we have to feel safe and have a safe group. But once that's there, being able to share our stories and our journey and find out that, yes, we are different, but that we are far more alike, that we might feel broken, but that we're really not broken. We are just people who have had some challenges in life.
Yeah. Yeah, well said. Not as a clinical psychologist, but as a fellow human being, as a woman, as you've gotten older, what have you learned that maybe you didn't know years ago? Or things that you appreciate more now than perhaps you did then? And what have you learned about love?
Boy, those are some pretty deep questions. Wow. So if I don't answer any, you let me know, and I'm happy to answer them.
Sure.
I have learned more in my 50s than in all my prior years put together. Why? Because I think I've slowed down to metabolize. I am getting it. I am getting life. Of course, I learned a lot. I would say I did learn a lot in my 40s, but I was so busy raising children and doing what had to be done in my earlier years, and so filled with fear in my, you know, teen years. That so for me, my 40s and beyond have been, they've been my life. They have been where if you look at life as far as growing, they have been growing, and not by accident. I have dug deep. I have done and continue to do my work. So I would say that is one of the biggest gifts for me, as well as realizing the preciousness of every day.
Yeah.
The absolute preciousness. And the other piece is that I've really learned is my responsibility, my deep responsibility to continue to know my moral code, live my moral code, walk my talk, and when I don't do as well as I want to do, to make my amends and try to do better the next day. So that's how I try to live every day, and I take that very seriously, whether it's picking up litter as I walk, whether it's taking care with, you know, smiling at people and listening. I really take that seriously. And then lastly, what have I learned about love? That's such a good question, because to me, I've learned that love is an action word. And if I had to sum it up, I would say that I think we use the word love very loosely because we only have one word for it, you know, in the English language, unlike some other cultures and other languages. And so what I look at is how important it is that if you say you love someone, that you must act in love.
Yes.
That you must be a person who is showing love, which to me is integrity, kindness, tenderness. And so I think if we break it down and start using, for me, if I am serious about loving people, and I am, that I always want to be as integrous and kind and tender or compassionate, whatever you'd like to call it, as possible with myself, because that's where it starts from, and then with others. And I try so hard to live that. I don't always succeed, but I certainly do try.
Yeah. And again, I'm thinking of your two books, Joy from Fear, the emphasis on fear. This one, we've been talking about aging joyfully, and now I think about some of my older friends or even my parents who are still alive. And they made comments to me, and I'm thinking, like, wow, that's got to be pretty strange. They're at an age now where everybody they know as friends or family are all dead. Mm-hmm. They're the only ones left. And so as you age joyfully, as you age, you go through more loss during those years. And what do you share with some of your clients who might bring that up as an issue too? Just loss of any kind, grief of any kind.
I really appreciate the five stages of grief and how it's, you know, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance, and how it's not linear, and that sometimes we process certain parts of those again and again and again before we reach acceptance, if we do get to the acceptance, and how important it is to be aware of those stages. And for me to realize, and I've lost both my mom and my dad, and pets that have been deeply loved by me and people who I have loved very deeply, and realizing that too, and this is where my spiritual side comes in, that too is a part of life. And that is one of the reasons I love a yoga practice, because you learn not to cling and you learn not to hold on too tightly. And so for me to realize that, yes, my mom and dad might be gone from this plane, you know, they might, my pets might be gone, my other beloved people might be gone, but that I definitely can feel their presence, because some people say, oh, you know, that's ridiculous, you know, what's gone is gone. And I think, okay, well, you believe in physics and you believe in the conservation of matter on one page, but what's wrong with when I'm talking about conservation of matter over here? What part of that, you know, all of a sudden doesn't matter, right? Uh-huh. And so I like to look at it that way, that we, yes, it hurts to lose that which gives us safety and security, but just like a rose, and I really am into the image of a rose lately, of how that shows us that it's not just the rosebud that's important. It is not just the flowering rose or even the rose that's losing its leaves, but also, once pollinated, that beautiful, stark rose hip that is so powerful. And so that rose, we could look at it as, oh, it's gone through so much loss. Or I really like to look at roses now as, oh, it's evolved. And that's the cycle of life. It may be uncomfortable. It may bring up great sadness and challenge at times. And that is both the bane of our existence and the joy of our existence, because that, and you know, people have said it far better than I can, but that which we have loved deeply, that is also, the depths to which we feel that pain tells us that we have loved equally as deeply.
That's beautiful. You know, I love how you end this book, Aging Joyfully. It's a postscript, Joyfully Living Your Dreams. In a few minutes that we have remaining, can you just share the story of Louisa, who at age 62 embarked on a new journey?
Yes, and that is Louisa, and she is an actual client who came to me and was just woebegone. Everything in her life, you know, the man she had been with forever, 35 years, had, you know, disappeared on her to be with another woman, and then, you know, she came to me and we worked through some of her dreams and her sadnesses and her paralyzing fears, paralyzed to be alone. She had lost her mother and her father. And then she found out that she had a supposedly incurable cancer. But part of her wanted to experience being loved and feeling deeply and truly loved. And she went through her journey, and I was, you know, I stayed by her side through the journey. And she just was as weak as she was at times, and going through her cancer and her chemotherapy, she still had the courage to date and meet a man who was her angel and not at all what she expected to come her way. he's very different. I've met him. He's amazing. Very different physically from what she had anticipated coming into her life. And yet they ultimately married. They are deeply in love. She beat her cancer against all odds and is just really faced her fears. And she would drive from quite a distance to come to her appointments, never missed one. And, you know, we slowly were able to see each other less and less frequently. And now she'll check in with me by email and let me know how she's doing. But what a nice, beautiful story of a woman who was taking aging as part of her did want to collapse and give up. And the other indomitable part just wanted to live and blossom for the first time in her life.
Yeah. I want to encourage all my listeners to learn more about the work that you're doing here in this world. What is your web address?
My web address is Dr. Carla, C-A-R-L-A, Manley.com. So it's www.drcarlamanly.com. Yeah. Or you can type in Aging Joyfully, and it'll take you to me as well.
There you go. The books are Joy from Fear and also Aging Joyfully. And Dr. Carla Manley, it's been a delight to have you on the program today. Thank you for sharing your time with us.
Oh, thank you, Richard. It has been an absolute pleasure and a delight. Thank you.
It was a delight to have Carla on today's program. I would encourage you to check out her website. And towards the end, she shared the story of Louisa. And so what I want to do is use Carla's words in describing a little bit more about that in her postscript in her book. She writes, "Louisa's story is most beautiful, for her journey has been one of incredible courage and strength. Life has never been easy for this dear soul, yet she has moved forward one step at a time. She was intent on finding the life of her dreams. Even when faced with one loss and challenge after the other, Louisa would not give up hope. And indeed, when her hope did falter, mine was there to lend loving support. For in truth, that is our greatest gift in life, our ability and willingness to live in love and faith, and to offer these gifts to others. As in many things, this is an area where women shine. And so, trust that I support you and hold you in my heart as you move forward in your own journey. Know that I have faith and hope enough to share with you. And when your light of faith feels dim, trust that hope and love are always there for you. When your light of faith feels strong, strive to share your light and love with others. And you'll find that your radiance grows the more you embrace your powers of love, faith, and joy. There is no time like now, these precious mature years of life, to embrace a love-filled life. There is no better time than now to follow your joyful dreams. Thank you from the bottom of my heart for taking this journey with me. It's been a joy, a privilege, and a deep delight." Again, these two fine books are Joy from Fear and also Living Joyfully, both from Dr. Carla Mann, and that's her website, drcarlamann.com. And that is today's program. Our website is richardbrendan.com. So for engineer Thomas Gismondi and production coordinator Angel Richardson, you've been listening to Journey's Fire. We're inspiring the fire within, one broadcast at a time.